Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is very nice to have you with us. It's May 28th, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and really a delight to have you all here. Another fairly nice day, and we thank you for spending some time with us to check in, take the pressure, take the pulse of what's going on in the world, and find out what's happening. We do so with you each and every morning, and we are delighted to have you with us today. Let me introduce our group to you. A reminder, you can always join us via email. If you have a question or a comment as to what we're discussing, we just ask that you keep your letter short and to the point and on topic. And you can send them to panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Shartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning again, Joe. We're constantly in touch and always wonderful to hear the magic that you do with this program. I just personally want to thank you for everything you're doing. It's
well,
just fabulous.
Thank you. Aren't you nice? And right back to you. It's really fun. We have a great lineup today. So let me get to it and invite everybody in. And then we'll get started and talk about what's going on. We have a very varied list of topics to discuss, so we'll get to that. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius-Kelly joins us. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, Joe and everyone. How is everyone? I'm feeling pretty good this morning.
Yeah, I am too. It's the nice weather. And, and you know, sunshine always helps. A little, you know, some good news with the bad news. And yeah, we'll take what we can get.
Yeah. Right.
UAlbany adjunct professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
So nice to have you with us. And we welcome community.
Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson is with us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I just want to say I really do miss seeing you and Alan and all the other panelists, and I just thank you for making the effort to keep this going.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, we'll figure out some way. We should have a Zoom check-in to see how everybody's doing. Yeah. It's good to have you here, and thank you, and it's just good to hear your voice. Again, panel at WAMC.org if you would like to get in on our conversation, panel at WAMC.org. A lot to talk about this morning. The big story, of course, that just came out, 40.8 million out of work in the past 10 weeks. More than one in four U.S. workers have lost their jobs since coronavirus shutdowns began. Last week, an additional 2.1 million people filed for unemployment benefits. What does that mean? It means 26% of our labor force, more than a quarter of the civilian labor force, out of work in the month of April. Employment dropped steeply in most areas of the country in recent weeks, the Federal Reserve said on Wednesday. A Fed survey found that employment continued to fall sharply in retail and in leisure and hospitality sectors. Not hard to figure out why. Alan.
Well, it's a very depressing situation. I'm even more depressed by what I saw going on in Minneapolis today.
Which we'll touch on, yes, of course.
And the kind of incipient racism which we see in this country, which is just so awful. And it doesn't add to the terrible plight that this country is in and has been led to, frankly, by the guy who's sitting in the White House. It's very, very distressing.
Vera?
Yeah, I mean, talk about changing the mood in an instant, right? I'm just thinking about all these families who have lost somebody in terms of human loss, and then they're suffering through unemployment issues and other economic struggles. It is truly disturbing to think about how many people are suffering economically and try to figure out how to get through the summer. And that is an incredibly high number for unemployed in terms of unemployment statistics. And we do need significantly more leadership to get through this period, because opening up the economy or not, it is not like everyone will be out there spending money immediately because people may not have it. People may have more immediate concerns. So this is a clear period of economic recession, if not depression, and we will see a very slow recovery in the next few years. So this is something that will be a long-term issue to be resolved. Depressing indeed. So,
you know, we've heard just over the last week, Boeing cutting more than 12,000 jobs after the sudden drop in air travel hit the airplane manufacturing giant very hard. A number of retailers, JCPenney, Neiman Marcus, J. Crew, all filing for bankruptcy, tax revenues dwindling, cities large and small are facing deep budget deficits, forcing them to furlough municipal workers. Nearly 1 million government workers were laid off in April alone. So, Rosemary, really a lot to take into account.
Yeah, I hope you aren't looking for me to be the voice of optimism and sunshine here, because I am not.
I rarely am, actually.
there isn't. And another number you didn't mention yet is 100,000 dead, more than any place else in the world, even though we have the best health infrastructure, arguably, in the world, and it could have been prevented. Bad leadership. We are expecting an avalanche of evictions because people cannot pay rent. So the economic downturn is going to deepen. I mean, I hope the president's people are right that it'll turn around quickly. I don't see it myself. There's predictions that a second wave of the disease brought about by opening too soon, which we're seeing everywhere in the country, including maybe even New York, I don't know, means more could be affected, more people could be sickened and killed. So, no, it's the short-term outlook is pretty bleak.
Terry.
Well, it's hard for me even to bring any real optimistic perspective to this other than just the fact that we do have an election coming up where we do have a chance to make significant changes. The thing that's disturbing the most to me of all of this is that there has just continued to be zero leadership from the executive branch of our government, and they're in a constant state of denial. And the president's lack of empathy towards the citizens that he represents to me is just astonishing. And I just don't know how much worse things must get before the American public rises up and just insists that he be removed and replaced with someone who can actually play the role of a leader, which we need. We keep saying we're all in this together, but the reality is, from the federal government's perspective, we're not. It's kind of like everybody is on their own. Every state is on their own. We've really got to come together as a country, and that can only be done with leadership at the top.
What does it say, Alan? I mean, it's just we're going to talk about this in, I think, a couple of different cases this morning. But as Rosemary so rightfully mentioned, and I want to read a little bit from the, I think, really incredible article that the Washington Post put out in regards to 100,000 lives lost. But so in that case, in this case of jobs, all of that seems to be ignored by the president. He's not tweeting about any of this. He's not talking about any of this. He's not saying this is what I'm going to do about the jobless numbers. He didn't even mention the fact that we had gone over 100,000 lives lost in this country. That ignoring of these big problems, and I ask you this as a political scientist, of is that a strategy for the fall? Because it doesn't seem to be one that is that you just shut your eyes and ignore everything.
Joe, it is a strategy, of course, and you're exactly right with using that word. The strategy is you don't mention anything that could come back and bite you in the can. Look, he is treating the American people with disrespect. That's the word of the time. He's treating us with disrespect. He thinks we don't know anything. He thinks we will blindly follow his nonsense. He was called a fool by Joe Biden for his remarks on masks. But he thinks we're the fools. I mean, think about that for a second. He thinks we're the fools. He thinks he can say anything, he can get away with anything, he can play on our prejudices and all the rest, and that will work for him. He thinks we're the fools, and the question is, are we?
So I wanted to tell a little story because a friend of mine moved from the East Coast to Michigan over the weekend for a job, and when the moving truck arrived in Michigan and the crew there was unloading her boxes, they refused to wear masks and, you know, bringing the boxes into the new house and unpacking. And she basically decided they couldn't unpack and, they could unload, but they couldn't unpack her things because she was too afraid that they, you know, they would carry in the virus or cause other problems. And she asked them repeatedly to wear masks, and their response was that she should educate herself about the reality of mask wearing and that this was just an East Coast thing and not really relevant for Michigan. So it is a political strategy. It is a way to divide the country into those that are elitist, leftist, East Coasters or West Coasters versus the heart of the country where one has the real facts, apparently.
Rosemary?
Well, it actually is not true that he didn't mention the 100,000 number, Joe. He tweeted that we should be thanking him and honoring him for keeping that number 12 times lower than he says it might have been had he not taken the amazing leadership actions that he did. So it goes beyond lack of sympathy. It's such a intense narcissism. He actually thinks he's doing right. And he is using COVID, moreover, for all of his political aims. I think you're seeing it now. This fight over Facebook and social media is really scary. He's going to come out with an executive order. And he's doing this, as many of people say, it's a distraction. But I'm sorry, it's a fight against First Amendment rights. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, which is likely to do that, we could lose those. We do not have a court favorable to the press right now. Trump is playing us for a fool, and he's doing more than playing us. He's winning by that strategy.
The only problem I have with what you just said, Rosemary, I agree with almost all of it, is how do we know whether he's thinking it, what he's thinking, whether he really believes it? I don't think he does believe it. I think he thinks it's the way to get over.
Believes what, Alan?
Well, that he believes he's done such good work in having this thing contained. You know, when you say he believes it, I don't know that. I don't know that. I think he may be so evil, that's the word I'm going to use, that he knows damn well he said in the beginning there would be 5 cases in the United States, and now there are 100,000 dead. And he's not stupid in that sense. I think he thinks he can get over on everybody because he is smarter than we are, and he knows how to lead the pack.
I think narcissism is the simplest single answer that explains everything. And the narcissist sees everything in terms of themselves. And while there may be some really deep-rooted, long-buried insecurity, he acts and tries to believe that what he does is right. So, yeah, I think he says, well, 100,000, that's a lot, but if I didn't act, it would have been a million, and nobody could have stopped the virus. No one anticipated that. All things he's actually said. So I don't know. You may be right. He may be totally evil, but it seems to me that mental illness is a better explanation than inherent evil in a person.
Yeah, and also I wanted to mention, I think a lot of people in this country simply do not understand that perhaps almost all of the 100,000 plus who died because of coronavirus could have lived many more years, could have lived perhaps decades more. And I think that is something that is not considered. A lot of people seem to believe that many victims of COVID-19 would have died anyways. Sort of this casual rejection of the loss of life unless it is a member of your own family or extended family. This idea that it is mostly affecting elderly, nursing home residents, and it is so callous. It is so shockingly devoid of humanity to not reflect on this incredible loss of human life. And in many ways, what we need in this country is some more information about the years lost, the years of love and contribution to society and family. I mean, there's so many people we have lost who could have been active members of society, and we don't think of it that way. 100,000, what does it tell us? We it doesn't even bring out emotion in the sense that, I mean, yes, it is a horrifically large number, but what does it tell us really in depth about the loss of life, the loss of humanity?
We do have to take a break, so I'll pause there and we'll come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Vera Akarios-Kelly. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We do have a want to get to the letters here and start off there. We got this from a listener who says, I'm sad to say that our street in central Massachusetts is an example of what's happening in the U.S. About a third of our street could care less about the pandemic. They invite large groups to their house, don't take any precautions on our little beach. I've reached out to our town selectmen. They aren't posting or monitoring the situation in this crowded, unhealthy beach. That from a listener in Massachusetts. We also go to Bob, who says Trump's behavior towards lost and living Americans isn't disrespectful. It's contemptuous. Disrespect is demeaning. What Trump is doing negates the value of Americans' lives altogether. Margarita says, what I never hear anyone talk about regarding November and voting Trump out is that Biden won't take office until January 20th. Even if Biden wins, we are stuck with Trump for nearly three more months, a good chunk of time during the second wave we will probably have. My question for the panel is, what first steps can Biden take in the catastrophe he will be walking into? Interesting question. Alan? Yeah.
Well, obviously, the thing that one has to do is to hold him accountable and to say right from the very beginning, you know, you can't do this, or and to have Biden say, if you did something, which I'm assuming he's going to do. And I think, by the way, when you say you never hear anybody talking about it, we've talked about it and we've gotten a lot of letters about it. And it is very, very scary because a lot of damage can be done in that time. There's no question. But Biden can say, don't do that, because the first thing I'm going to do when I get into office is to just say that that's not going to happen. So it certainly is possible that the public can have play a role in that, and that Biden himself can play a role.
I would take a very decisive step if I was Biden and assemble the most powerful scientific group of experts on virological issues and get them to develop a plan to immediately address mass testing shortages, tracing issues, and work with the governors to develop a national plan of response. I mean, the scientific search of what has to be done is something that Biden can do immediately once he's elected.
Yeah, but that wasn't the question. Vera, that wasn't the question.
I think the question is wrong, though. It's what Biden should do. And, I mean, Trump showed the way for that. He acted as president long before he was actually inaugurated, including having Flynn negotiate with a foreign power in contradiction to what Obama was doing. The real question is what Americans would do. If he's out, if we're in the middle of a second wave, it's up to us. We social distance, we wear masks, we stay at home when you can, and don't listen to Trump policies that would get you out, that would put you in danger. Stay off the beaches. These are all things Americans should do. It doesn't matter what the president says.
Yeah, but what if he does something really dangerous? Gets us into a war, or leads us into a situation where he does an executive order which is going to do tremendous damage, even in the few months that he has. What do you do about that? That's the question.
Terry?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that he can do behind the scenes prior to taking office, and I think he is probably doing a lot of that now. He first of all has to assemble his entire team and be ready to go from day one. But in the meantime, he can be developing relationships with decision makers at all different levels of government, state level, at the federal level. He can be building relationships with the leaders in corporate America, relationships with foreign leaders, so that he's beginning to explain to them what his plans are, getting them to buy into it so that they are less likely to follow any lead from the Trump administration in those 3 months.
John writes to us and says, I'm not picking on Rosemary, but best healthcare system in the world? ! Back in February, several of the CBC podcasts I listened to were ruefully predicting utter disaster when COVID-19 hit the U.S. The reason that every one of these Canadian podcasts gave was the same. The U.S. healthcare system is so disastrously broken that things will get very, very bad, which is what we've seen. The only people who have the best healthcare in the world are the American oligarchy.
I think that you're confusing healthcare coverage and insurance with the system, the medical research and public health. Those are all systems that Americans have championed and have done well. And that's the excuse we get, isn't it? When we say, why is no one covered? Well, you know, you have to support this amazing medical research and innovation system that we have. I know, as somebody who was overseas, that, and anything went wrong with me, with teeth or with blood work, I wanted to be in the United States, not where I was. So, you know,
well,
I mean,
Rosemary, I wouldn't quite agree with you. I think there are a number of countries where the healthcare system is significantly better than the United States.
That's why I said arguably, Vera, arguably. But the United States is the hugest country we're talking about. If you want to talk about Scandinavia, okay, I can't compete with that. But there's far fewer people and far fewer problems.
Most of Western Europe has significantly better access for the vast majority of its population. And, I don't know that I would simply argue that it is, you know, the only or the most prestigious location for research, because you have to remember that there are a number of countries where major medical research centers exist, and they have now basically overtaken the CDC. I mean, the CDC
Nor did I argue that. Mm-hmm. I said it's arguably one in the best of the world. Certainly nothing in our system should have predicted the worst number of deaths in the world, Vera.
You know, I think you're both right. I think you're both right. Look, we can certainly substantially improve on the way in which we deliver medicine and medical help to everybody in this country. We know that. On the other hand, Rosemary is certainly right that we spend an awful lot of money on it. And when you talk about the kind of things that an NYU or Cornell or any of those things are doing in this country, it's extraordinary based research. So you're both right. I think this country has done remarkable things. But on the other hand, we have a long way to go before everybody gets treated fairly.
So yesterday was the day that we passed officially 100,000 American lives lost. The Washington Post article on this, as I said, I thought was pretty impressive. 100,000 Americans dead in less than 4 months. It's as if every person in Edison, New Jersey or Kenosha, Wisconsin died. It's half the population of Salt Lake City or Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's about 20 times the number of people killed in homicides in that length of time, about twice the number who die of strokes. The death toll from the coronavirus passed that hard-to-fathom marker on Wednesday, which slipped by like so many other days in this dark spring. One more spin of the earth, one more headline, and a numbing cascade of grim news. Nearly 3 months into the brunt of the epidemic, 14 14% of Americans say they know someone who has succumbed to the virus. These 100,000 are not nameless numbers, nor are they mostly famous people. They are overwhelmingly elderly. In some states, nearly two-thirds of the dead were 80 years old or older. They are disproportionately poor and Black and Latino. Among the younger victims, many did work that allowed others to stay at home out of the virus's reach. For the most part, they have died alone, leaving parents and siblings and lovers and friends with final memories not of hugs and whispered devotion, but of miniature images on a computer screen, tinny voices on the phone, hands pressed against a window. All true, and as it says in this article, that it passes by and slips by like so many other, that it just becomes part of what they refer to as a numbing cascade.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Joe, while we're on it, we have 1 minute to break. I wanted to issue a typical Shartakian apology. I said in an earlier commentary this morning at 7:40, I said something about the, you know, that we don't have a death penalty in this country. And when somebody had their knee on somebody's neck, that was a death penalty. And of course, we do have death penalties in some states in the country. So I want to make that clear. When I do something that is not quite right, I want to say so.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we will talk more about this. We'd love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. We have Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Vera Acarius Kelly. Just before a break, reading about this 100,000 dead. Rosemary, a point obviously you have made many times. I don't know the proper way of marking such an event, but it certainly seems that it's something that we should pause and take a look at.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you remember, Fauci and Dr. Birch said initially that you follow all the rules for mitigation and we'll end up between 100 and 225,000. And we're there already. And now we're not following the mitigation rules. So it makes me worried. I don't know what's different now than in March. Does anybody? We stepped aside for 2 months. The deaths have leveled off, although they're still steadily increasing in places we didn't see them before. And now we're going back to the way things were.
Right.
Does that not make anyone else worried? Am I the only one?
No, I think there's a lot to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, all of us, I think, are quite worried about what the future will bring. But to mark this moment of 100,000 lives lost, I would love some public official to speak to this grief in the United States that exists in many parts of this country, and to mention a few stories about all the contributions these 100,000 people have made to our communities on a local level, on a regional level, on a national level. Why not highlight the depth of loss that we are experiencing? We do it for veterans. We do it for a number of community members, famous people perhaps, but what about people that have consistently been good citizens in this country, helped their neighbors, helped their communities? Why do we now simply assume we can announce a number of 100,000 and move on? There is incredible grief in this country, in particular areas, much more so than in others, but it is important for public officials to acknowledge it on a human level.
Well, you're right, of course. But the problem is that some people are trying to do that. I mean, I think, you know, in our area, for example, I was watching Channel 13 in Albany the other day, and they're doing some of those things. Mm-hmm. The New York Times printed, you know, all of those thousand names of people and told their stories. I think there is an attempt, Vera, to do some of that, but you're quite right. It isn't enough.
Well, and also,
you know,
go ahead, Terry.
Oh,
no, go ahead.
I was just following up on that line of thought there. I do think that you have seen and you will continue to see various elected officials at various levels of government throughout the country doing their best to memorialize these deaths. But the problem is that until we have that type of memorial, that type of message coming from a credible leader at the very top level of our government, the president, it's rather ineffective at bringing us all together. I mean, we saw this, for instance, during the Charlottesville attacks, where we saw the president come out and try to give both sides credit. But we saw other elected officials doing their best to really state what had really happened there and trying to memorialize that for what it was. This president is just incapable of offering that type of memorial. He just can't do it. And it's incredibly frustrating. It's incredibly depressing. This is more people that have been killed in the Vietnam War. It's more people than were killed in the Korean War. It's more Americans than it's almost more Americans than were killed in World War I. I mean, these are significant numbers that are going to put a place in our history books that is just unprecedented.
But we qualify it, and that is what worries me, that I find depressing too, which is, okay, 100,000 people, but they were 80 or older. They were poor. They were black. They were Latino. Not solely, but the majority. And that obviously adds into this equation as to why it is, I'm not saying it's overlooked, but it is not, I think, given the tone and the severity of thought that it's being given.
It's very hard for Americans to get a grip on the sheer volume of this. The words don't seem to do it justice. More people than killed in the years, all the years of the Vietnam War. It doesn't have any impact until it is someone close to you, even if he is 85 years old or is black or non-white or a non-Trump family member. It has to be someone in your own family or you just are not going to have the feeling. Somebody on Fox said, 100,000, that's like a drop in the bucket. Terribly callous. But in fact, that's really true. None of those 100,000 are people you know.
I want to just read.
I think journalists are struggling to try to get this through. Mm-hmm.
Right. I want to read a thing, just a part of this Washington Post article. And it's basically saying what we're saying here. But the demise of these 100,000 people has had strangely little public impact in a country with a long history of honoring its fallen and committing to common cause in their memory. Americans have responded to the coronavirus pandemic with outpourings of gratitude, New Yorkers' nightly chorus of cheers for healthcare workers, for example, and widespread cooperation, including extraordinary quick pivots to staying at home and wearing masks. But there have been few expressions of public grief, no gold stars in the windows of families where people died, no outcry for national unity or memorials, as happened after September 11th. In this trauma, the enemy is unseen. There is no one against whom to mobilize the nation's energy, anger, and frustration. That seems to be an issue, but it also seems to be part of the American character, which has long been that we're not good in dealing with death.
You know, one of the fears that I have, Joe, is of this, is that what the president could possibly do is what he may be capable of doing, because he's certainly not capable of offering leadership in his capacity, but he may be capable of trying to offer a way to vent our anger, or at least to allow his base to vent their anger. And I think it could be directly connected to actions that he takes against China in the way of a military action. I'm very concerned about him taking military action as a way to allow the American public to vent their anger and frustration. That could happen.
You know, I said so at 7:40 this morning, not to try to play one up with you, but I'm scared to death that in order to win re-election, he might do something military with China. Would anybody put it past him, knowing what we know about this guy now?
Well, it gives people a way. It would give certain people, certainly his base, a way to come out and get excited about something, to support something, and to really vent all of their energy and frustration about this virus towards a visible enemy. And that's part of what's missing here, is that you can't see the virus. You can't point at the virus. You can't pick it out of a crowd and say it's that thing over there. And by putting all of the focus on a particular country, it becomes more a unifying factor for many. And I think he might try to do that because he's capable of taking those types of evil moves. He's not capable of showing empathy and having
would
an
action,
national memorial.
Military action against China look like? Would we defend the protesters in Hong Kong? Because I'm not totally sure I'm against that. I think it's more appalling that we're pulling away from the Hong Kong protesters.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
So I agree with Rosemary. I don't think there is this is going to be an easy sort of a military conflict to engage in because you can't really send ground troops, which Trump doesn't want to do anyways, into China because that would lead to massive loss of life and would be not helpful to his agenda. And simply going on a bombing raid or something crazy like that would also result in massive repercussions for us here because the Chinese have technology to reach us. So, I mean, this is sort of an approach that I don't believe Trump is going to engage in. He's a bully at heart. He likes to engage in fights that he thinks he can win. Against China, he knows he can't just win and make points for his reelection. So I don't buy this approach at all. I think he'd rather hand over Hong Kong to the Chinese and fully and say, well, we won't be dealing with Hong Kong anymore since they're taken over by China anyways. We don't care about the protesters so much. We will no longer transfer our technology to Hong Kong either. So we're denying Hong Kong the ability to trade the way we've traded with them
before. Vera, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But this is a guy who is now taking a look at the polls. He's seeing himself way behind in this election and getting further behind. And if anybody has seen Trump in action, you know that the standard intellectual sort of restraints are not there with him. I think you're right. All of those things that you said are absolutely correct in a rational person's mind. I don't think he's rational, and I do think he's capable of doing something really dangerous here.
And I don't think that
there is one other possibility from what Vera listed, and that would be a military, a naval encounter in the South Sea. But again, I'm not totally opposed to that. What China's been doing there is really scary, and I'm not sure that his agenda is served by anything that's military against China. There are other actions, as you're saying. I don't know.
Terry?
Well, his only agenda is to get reelected. I mean, that's the only agenda that he has. And I don't think that death bothers this president. I don't think he understands it. I don't think he accepts it. I don't think it bothers him. I don't think it even factors into the calculations and decisions that he makes. So I don't think the number of people that could be lost in a military conflict, whether it be in China or on our own soil, I really don't think this president is capable of processing that. It's going to be about whether it works for him or it doesn't.
Sure, no problem.
What's that?
No, I mean, there's a significant difference between the 100,000, as we just discussed, and the potential for a military engagement. We're talking about people that Trump does understand. He is a bully. He does understand his central position in this performance that he always does. And when there are 50,000 caskets coming back of U.S. soldiers, you better believe he will care. What he doesn't care about is the calculation of what he considers our elders that he doesn't respect and doesn't value predominantly. That's what the difference is. He does understand that 50,000 caskets coming back will end his future immediately.
We do need to take a break, so we'll pause here. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those as soon as we come back, I promise. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Vera Akarias-Kelly making up the panel this morning. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Vera Akarias-Kelly. I promise letters. Here they are. John says, Vera, I disagree. Trump has shown to be enough of a narcissist to valve first how military conflict serves him. He is immune from military casualties as he is from epidemic casualties. We go to Alan, who says, just because the virus is invisible, its results are not, and clearly the effect of Trump's response are highly visible. Trump is our enemy. Russ says, could it be that the enormity of the number of lives lost has been gradually increasing, invisible to most of us? On 9/11, thousands died in one place all at once, which was easier for people all around the country to recognize. And with 9/11, humans were accused of doing it. Virginia says, I know it may be a long shot, but if Biden is elected in a landslide and both the House and Senate go Democratic, couldn't the Congress swiftly impeach Trump again to stop him taking scary military action or failing to protect the American people?
Interesting idea. I don't think it'll happen. First of all, it'll be a while before the Senate gets its stuff together and new chairman and the rest of it. And, you know, I think what I'm worried about is they're going to let him off the hook altogether. That when he gets out, everybody says, leave him alone. It'll look bad. It'll look like we're taking advantage of our newfound and, you know, power. And that would be very discouraging for me.
Well, wait,
Senate, it also would be inaugurated until January. So you still have McConnell and Ed Hall in charge.
Absolutely.
No impeachment.
That's exactly right. Well, I understand the frustration of the letter writer. But that ain't going to happen.
Terry, you were going to say?
I was just going to say what Rosemary said. I mean, nobody takes office until January 1. So by then, he is already out of office. There's no need to impeach him, assuming he actually leaves office, which is a whole other thing we continue to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Gail writes and says, wage cuts of 10% in April, projections of business real estate abandonment and follow-on cuts in those now working at home, scared witless consumers and the China trade boogeyman telling me we'd better retool for the new normal fast. Sue says, with regard to addressing the 100,000 deaths, Joe Biden has done this. Please see his video message telling the people that the nation grieves with you.
Yeah, and he has done a very good job on that, actually. He has done something that, you know, one would expect from the president. But, of course, we will never get that.
Marvin writes to us and says, why brag about your roles when you are still walking to work? What good is it if you can't take you from point A to point B? Our healthcare system has become a cash cow for wealthy middlemen. They pad the system with profit-making schemes. Citizens' health should be held hostage to profit-making schemes. Brian says, I think Trump is looking for a fall resurgence of the virus, and he hopes it hits those states that have been less than compliant with things like social distancing and masks. He will then push a massive federal aid package to red and purple states in a bid to buy the 2020 election. Daniel says, Mayor Bloomberg pledged to help the Democratic nominee defeat Trump. Is he doing so?
I think so.
Well,
I'm on a
nominee.
Yes, there isn't an official nominee, and I know he's been working on the virus and the testing and tracing and so forth. But I'm sure the time will come.
Contact tracing.
And then Melinda says Biden will have zero control over what Trump does between November 3rd and January 2nd, 2021. Trump will cause more destruction than we've ever seen if he does not win, along with ranting all day, every day, that the election was rigged because of how vicious Trump can be, as we have observed thus far. We go to Bobby, who says it is difficult to address the absence of something, but what Vera... Oh, all right. My computer just went out. I'll get that letter back, I promise. Steve says the executive order Trump is supposedly considering regarding social media is removing the protections they currently have, the responsibility for the content that people post. If the protections were indeed to be removed, it would harm the extremists more than help them, as Twitter, Facebook, etc. would have no choice but to start tossing all the Looney Tunes content to protect themselves against litigation. I, for one, believe that the aggregation and social media platforms should be held responsible for the information that they publish, just as the real media are now. David says, didn't the feds just give Boeing a bailout and they turned around and fire people? So where did our money go? Asks David. Dennis says, if Trump is no longer president next year, can and will responsible members of the media no longer cover everything he says, or will he remain irresistible, or will they continue to amplify his voice?
He will remain irresistible. He is a potent, perhaps unprecedented in our lifetime, political force, and highly unusual. He will be in the news forever.
All right, so let's go to another story that I want to talk about. Alan mentioned it earlier, and that, of course, is what is happening. The very sad story of what is happening in Minneapolis and the tensions mounting in that city. Anger continues to boil over in Minneapolis over the police treatment of a black man who died after an officer kneeled on his neck and ignored his pleas that he couldn't breathe while being arrested. The mayor of Minneapolis is among those calling for criminal charges to be filed against four now former city police officers involved in the death of 46-year-old George Floyd. Why does this keep? I mean, the most obvious question is, why does this keep happening?
Well, the question, Joe, is what the level of frustration over American racism is. It's terrible. And it's very, very clear that if you're not black, you don't fully understand what's happening because of skin, of the stupidity of skin pigmentation. You know, this has been brought home to me. I've mentioned it a couple of times, but this has been brought home to me because I have an African-American grandchild. And, you know, I mean, my tears are over what will happen if this guy goes out, this wonderful, wonderful young man goes out for a jog. And somebody says, there's a black man in my neighborhood, I think I'll kill him. Or he asked me to do something perfectly reasonable in Central Park and said that, you know, can you put your dog on a leash, please? That's the law. And she calls the police and then has to apologize for it and said it was a terrible thing that she did. But these are just the faces of American racism, which goes on every day and which is at the height, I believe, of Trump's whole approach to how to get reelected president of the United States, to harness that for himself. So this frustration of the fires and everything else, which, by the way, are not going to be good for the Democrats. Never are. Never is. Terrible. Just awful. It's just frustration over what can we do when our people are being killed.
Vera?
We have.
Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say we have a huge problem with our police forces, with the way they're recruited, the way they're trained, with systemic racism that could easily be ratted out, but it is not. And Obama was beginning to get at it with Department of Justice investigations into police departments, such as you saw in Ferguson, that led to widespread reform. And then Session gets in and knocks that all out, and we have not seen them ever picked up again under Trump. He supports and applauds brutality by police and by military as well. And this is one more effect. Yes, it goes back, as Alan points out, you know, decades, centuries in our history. But the current problem with police killing minority members of our communities for no reason, it's just awful, and it will not be fixed under a Trump administration.
But I thought it was interesting, and I agree with everything that's been said, but I thought it was interesting that almost immediately after the release of this video, police chiefs all across the country said that clearly the police officer behaved entirely ruthlessly, keeping his knee on a person's neck. That was not approved, not allowed, especially not, I mean, never use a knee on somebody's neck, never push somebody down and choke them when they plead for assistance. I mean, this was, and the other police officers, I think three of them that watched what was happening without intervening, it was an immediate response by a lot of different department heads and researchers that look into levels of police violence, and they said this particular incident within hours, they said this is a criminal matter. There is so much evidence to not only fire these officers, but bring them into a court of law.
But George... But George Floyd is still dead, and I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll take some, I guess, some solace in that, but I don't understand why. I mean, I think anybody who watched that video, whether you're a police officer or not, would think that it just, it's an excruciating 5 minutes.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it must be shocking to the core, except for what happened there with three police officers just simply watching. Why was there no interference? What does this group think that is allowed within this environment? And that also needs to be addressed.
Well, the whole incident just rips back the curtain on what our country is really made up of right now and has been for all of our history. We just have not dealt with this racial issue. And you have to wonder what was going through this police officer's mind that gave him the power to sit there as people were recording him to literally murder someone right before our very eyes. I mean, that's what we watched. We watched a police officer kill another human being right before our very eyes. And then what you saw amazingly was that no one there took any effort to try to resuscitate him, to try to help him. They just rolled him over like just a piece of garbage onto this stretcher and carried him away. And it's just awful and sad.
And there were a lot of people yelling, let him up, let him up. You've got your knee on his neck. He can't breathe. I mean, it wasn't as if we weren't catching that. You know, he was being warned from all quarters.
Right.
And by the way, this isn't the first time. We've seen this again and again. Los Angeles burned because
of it. All over again.
Yeah, exactly. And that was late to the game also compared to what happened in L.A. and King and all the rest of it. So we know that this is always going to be the underlayment of American society. And I've been saying all along, that's what this whole thing is all about.
Well, there,
this whole election is all about.
You know, there is that. But also, you know, you would think that there is an assumption by police officers that they are being taped and they are being watched and that their actions are going to be scrutinized. And why that isn't taken into account after so many of these tragedies, that I do not understand.
Well, because
they think they live in a world where they're untouchable.
Yeah, exactly. They're untouchable, and they have this perception that it doesn't matter if you're filmed because, you know what, in their eyes, there was this big, powerful black male body who was threatening them, and they needed to subdue this person. I mean, their perception of an all-powerful position in society, in addition to a completely out-of-control threat perception against, you know, of the black male body, is what that combination is deadly, and it has been deadly over and over and over again in this country.
And you know, Serpico lives among us. I mean, we can't forget all the way back to that. You know, letting a guy sit there with a bullet in his head because he wasn't going along with the thin blue line. This is something that really becomes so important. I think Rosemary's earlier words were right on target.
Yeah, it's systemic, and it's in our police departments, right from the bottom up. And Obama was just getting at it when Sessions dismantled the whole thing. Heartbreaking.
Alan,
Black lives do not matter in this country.
Alan, I want you just to go back and talk about something that you said that struck me, which was that this does always hurt the Democrats. How do you see it in this case?
Well, in the case of the Republicans are going to argue that, you know, if you elect the Democrats, you're going to have hell to pay. When Americans see a city burning, when they see buildings burning, when they see that kind of thing happening, they are not going to be where they should be in terms of American racism. Now, I understand that frustration. Believe me, I do. But I think what happens is when that frustration gets to the point that it does, and you see, buildings burning, then I think, that is an advantage to the Republicans. Rosemary, do you agree with that?
I do. When you said it, it struck me that, unfair as it is, and I myself blame Trump for everything, you know, for my mood on any given day, much less cities burning and people being murdered in the streets. But you are right. That's seen as a Democratic failure, and we want more police enforcement. We want more protection, and that helps the Republicans. Yeah.
I keep thinking about that woman in Central Park. I know I mentioned it already, but I'm telling you, it was hers by right.
Right.
It was hers by right to call the police and say, this black man is talking to me. That's a threat. It's unbelievable.
It really is.
And if you watch the video, my sons and I have been talking about this. I mean, it wasn't arrogant. She actually really was afraid. She, at least she looks it. And then she just lies. It's just unbelievable. And it is connected to this, that I'm going to tell them it was an African-American man. Like, that would make a difference. A white woman calling and saying that. And, of course, that's our whole history, too, right, where white women have claimed crimes by black men. Awful.
Yeah.
Well, and then we decide.
Well, and white women are believed often.
And until.
That, right?
Yes.
They are believed.
Exactly.
And without question, then the black man or boy is arrested and in the past was tortured and killed.
Yep.
You know, in the case of the Central Park video, so then it's what they do, and then city leaders are demanding that the woman be face charges of false accusation. I mean, does that do anything other than the?
Well, somebody told her to apologize real fast and real strongly, and she did.
She lost her job.
She did.
But it is a crime to file a false police report.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she should be charged. Yeah, we should be charging crimes here. I don't think it gets. I think actually, so funny, they both have the same last name. But the black man went on television and he was extremely eloquent.
He
called on people to stop threatening her. He goes, I report her. You know, I get her in trouble for threatening my life, and you get off by threatening hers. How does that make any sense? He's so reasonable. How she could have done that to him is just. She deserves what she's getting.
Well, Joe, I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to, at this point in time, try to be the optimistic voice on the air. I have thought about this. I don't think I can agree with this incident in Minneapolis hurting the Democrats. I think that we're at a point in time finally where the American public senses that this is yet another reflection of current modern times. Yes, we can look back in the past and see that this has happened before. But right now, we know for sure that we have a Republican Party and a Republican president that are enabling these types of things to happen, that support these things, that encourage these things, that want to see this type of divisiveness in our country. And I think there are enough people out there, both Democrats and independents, that see this for what it is. And when you kill a black man live on camera – for all to see, I think that it's a point where it actually begins to hurt the Republicans and this president. So I'm going to take the other side of that argument.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Well, I wish I could believe that.
I hope you're right.
I'm not surprised you say that, Mr. Democratic Senator. And And
somebody's
got to
take the other side here.
Yeah, I get it.
Too many people who just think that that black man was wrong from the minute he did not obey the policeman. He brought it on himself is how they see it.
I don't even agree
I wish you were right, Terry, but...
Yeah, I don't even agree with that. You know, I think it is... those policemen were immediately fired. Four policemen were immediately fired. There is a judicial system here in this country. Yeah. If it had been allowed to go through it, there would have been tremendous support for it, in my opinion. But burning buildings, I don't think many Americans like it.
All right.
They weren't arrested. That person wasn't arrested. I mean, we have to ask, why was this person not arrested? Any other person that killed someone would have been arrested. And so... It's hard not to look at this community and say, what choice do they have but to burn things down? The judicial system is not being allowed to happen as it should.
Well, no, that's not true, Terry. He killed someone in the commission of his duty as a police officer. It is not clear yet whether he should be charged. I think that's in the future. He would not have been immediately arrested. Never does that happen.
Well, he did.
No,
I'm
talking about a non-police officer. If you or me were to have done this, we would have been immediately arrested.
Sure, but we all know that we give special powers of violence to our police, and that's not unjustified. We have to see if that man does not end up being charged over, say, the next month, then we should have this conversation. But no, the system is set up now that he wouldn't be charged right away.
All right. I want to take a pause from this grim news that we are discussing and give you some insider baseball. We just learned moments ago from the New York State Associated Press Association that they have announced some awards, and I would like to announce them if I can. The New York State Associated Press Association has honored Alan S. Chartok with its Lifetime Achievement Award. Congratulations,
Alan.
Congratulations.
Wow, congratulations.
It sort of sounds like your life is over, though, Alan. Does that worry
you? Yeah, it does. I'm not dead.
Well, I mean, it's a Lifetime Achievement Award. That's pretty great.
Yeah, it's very nice. Incredible. I appreciate it.
New York State Associated Press Association has also, you will remember our dear friend Brian Shields, who retired in December. They have given him the Art Athens General Excellence of Individual Reporting Award as well. So the good and good news is, I can't even say that with a straight face. Unfortunately, wink, wink, there is no event this year to go to.
Oh, boy. I feel terrible. I can't go. That's awful.
So there's no awards dinner. So there's no dinner in your honor, Alan. But we'll virtually get together and just party the hell out of it. Yeah, I know. Take the tears out of your eyes now. Real quick, let me just mention a couple of others. First place for our wonderful staff here. Josh Landes has won an award for spot news coverage for about a tragedy hits Sheffield family. Also, our weathercasters, Paul Cayano and Garrett Argyanis, have won for best weathercast on WAMC. And then we got a couple second prize awards for public service for the housing series that WAMC did. Jesse King won for Play Ball, Vintage Teams Preserve Baseball History in New York. And we also got a second place award for our digital presence. So congratulations to everyone. Alan, congratulations to you. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Our last segment together, we have about 15 minutes left, and we'll try to get to as many topics and letters as we possibly can get to in the time that we have, and we will begin. You'll remember a while ago I started to read a letter, and then I accidentally pressed delete when I was halfway through it, and I promised you I would find it. I did. It's from Bobby, who says it's difficult to address the absence of something, but what Vera was talking about is exactly what we as a nation are missing. The role of the president in any national disaster or any tragedy that is of the collective, Challenger, Sandy Hook, 9/11, needs someone to allow everyone to feel that they are not alone in their grief, and their grief is felt by all Americans. This is what makes the numbers human. This is what gives us a sense of ourselves being and feeling together. This is what is absent, and we are all suffering from that lack of recognition of our grief collectively as so many souls leave this earth, and individually as parents, children, friends, and neighbors of those we have lost. The president is incapable of such feeling and action. He is a narcissist. Then we go to Tony, who says, I'd like to see the names of the officers published. Let them suffer publicly. Rushney says, why does this keep happening? Joe asked why the murder of black Americans by the hands of police officers continue to happen, which is because cops don't think they're racist. They don't realize that the way they treat people of color is more aggressive than white people because of underlying racist feelings. They justify their actions because they are handling suspects and have to protect themselves and others. Michael says, getting away with it requires finding 12 racists on the jury. Why do white police officers kill black men with impunity? Again, because getting away with it requires finding 12 racists on the jury. It seems this is still an easily attainable outcome. A letter from Larry, who says, as a gay HIV-positive man in his late 60s, this COVID loss reminds me of the early days of AIDS when no one cared about the huge loss because they were gay, of color, or addicts. It took ACT UP and others to make it personal. Eventually, the AIDS quilt really brought this home. What will it take now? Jody writes,
ACT UP is a really great example of what had to happen, namely unity around the notion that we respect all human life and that we mourn the loss. And that is exactly the model we should be looking for now. Pulling together, remembering those lives we lost and the many contributions they've made to our local communities. That is exactly what we need.
Sage writes, Alan said he doesn't think many Americans are glad to see buildings burning. How much more can people take? How many times can we see police abuse power so blatantly and people end up dead? How much longer can people of color and poor people live in terror while there is hardly ever any real justice for offending officers and therefore little deterrence to it happening again and again?
Well, in my own defense, Joe, I have to say, I think I said all of that. I mean, I did. I understand it. I was just making a political statement in terms of political science, which is we know that people don't like to see burning buildings and that it may help the Trumpers. But in terms of the frustration and what led to it and everything, I understand it completely. And I said it.
Right. Absolutely. Sage writes. I just read that one. I'm sorry. Yeah. David says, on Alan, you deserve the Lifetime Award. Congratulations, Alan. You are one of a kind. We are all the better for your efforts.
What about Lewis?
Well, they didn't give the award to Lewis. They gave it to
you. Well, I do have an identical twin.
Yeah.
It's
well,
one of a kind thing, you know.
Let's see. One more. Jody says, I agree. It would be wonderful if there could be some national show of mourning of the 100,000 lost. In a show of compassion for their viewers, why can't the various news outlets come together and create this? It could be as simple as setting aside airtime to show gravesites across the country and read names. And I agree with Alan, who mentioned this earlier, but many news organizations are doing this and doing quite a beautiful job over it over a period of time, both local and national. So for what it's worth, that is the case. We have a bunch of other stuff to talk about, and we have about 7 minutes to do it in. So let me throw a bunch of stories at you and see what happens. We did touch on this topic of Hong Kong, but Hong Kong has lost autonomy according to Mike Pompeo, saying that opening the door to U.S. action, the State Department announcement comes as President Trump weighs hard measures against China, which is expected to approve a national security law on Hong Kong today. Well, Vera, what do you think?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think I feel terrible for all the protesters in Hong Kong who, you know, in decades ago protested against the growing influence of the Chinese, or, you know, not decades, like a decade and a half ago, against against the incursion of the mainland Chinese politicians and security forces. And last year, the young people who so effectively pushed back and tried to deny the Chinese security apparatus complete control of the political system. And now, unfortunately, with the outbreak of COVID, they all have been pushed back into their apartments and haven't been able to be out and about and protest. And now, of course, Beijing is pursuing all kinds of strategies to control any kind of resistance against its growing influence. And the tragic moment is now that instead of trying to assist Hong Kongers who have resisted and pushed back and sacrificed so much in favor of maintaining a unique status, Pompeo is simply announcing it's over. We are abandoning any kind of sense of support for Hong Kongers at this moment, for all the 100,000 young people out and about, joined by workers and nurses and all the other Hong Kongers who are out there stating that they wanted a different Hong Kong in the future. And we're simply throwing that away.
I don't
saying,
think that's
well,
right.
It's over. It's over.
Vera, I have to interrupt. I do not think that's right. That was my first reaction when I read the story. But I think Pompeo is after Congress to remove trade preferences for Hong Kong. That goes along with Trump's policy of hurting China, and removing those trade preferences will really hurt China. And it also helps the protesters. So I think
it hurts our allies in Japan, it hurts our other Asian allies.
Go ahead. Vera, you first, then Rosemary, you respond.
Well, I wanted to say that is the easiest thing to do for the Trump administration, to try and go after China by denying Hong Kong a special trading status. But what that comes with is also the denial of a special political status. And once that happens in Hong Kong, the Chinese have even more reason to take over Hong Kong, because the Americans no longer have a protective shield of whatever it was worth over Hong Kong. In addition to that, it will hurt the Japanese and our allies, the Japanese. It will hurt other Asian countries that have special relationships with Hong Kong. So this is a massive destructive policy that will now divide entire areas of the world into you're either with us or against us. And that is certainly one of the plans that Trump is pursuing. But in fact, it is so it's such a crude instrument. Yes, it will. This policy that Pompeo is pursuing will anger Beijing, but Beijing is closer to Hong Kong. They will simply infiltrate and take over.
Rosemary,
I think this was a very terrible choice.
Yeah. Rosemary.
I that was my initial reaction, but Trump has not responded politically to the protests up to now. I thought we should have been in support of what they were doing months ago, the middle of last year. But here is a rare case where Trump's policies actually could end up helping the protesters. Hong Kong losing status means that the communist China is hurt, and that promotes Hong Kong's bid for more autonomy. Give us autonomy back so we get more trade.
The exact opposite will happen, because if Hong Kong is simply denied special status, then Hong Kong is denied any kind of opportunity to establish its own independent control for the trade with the outside world. Beijing will simply incorporate Hong Kong. This is a very poor choice.
Well, Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong is in danger right now. That law is passing today. America is having no influence over what the Chinese parliament does today. So the Trump administration is saying, okay, fine, here's the consequence of your policy, and it has a huge trade effect. I think a hurting communist China because of their action on Hong Kong cannot be bad for protesters.
Yes, it can, because the security forces will now completely crush without any international protest. It's over for Hong Kong.
That doesn't require American action at all. That could happen this afternoon as a result of the legislation that's going to pass.
All right,
we had actual positions on Hong Kong having a right to have a different status. We've given that up. This is awful.
In 2 minutes, Alan, Terry, do you want to weigh in on this?
Well, I saw it coming from the first day. I mean, I really did. I said so at the time. The moment, the Chinese got it back from the Brits, it was the die was cast. Dictatorships do not allow dissonance, and that's all there is to it.
And Terry?
Except we had the umbrella movement where people protested, and we had last year enormous amounts of public protests, and the Chinese did not invade and were basically nervous about what was happening in Hong Kong. Now their
different circumstances, different approach. They thought they could get away with it by having it seem like it was a democratic acquiescence to that bill in the legislature, but it wasn't to be. Now they're being the Chinese. They're being the dictatorship they are.
Yeah, and we're helping them now.
I'm not sure.
All right. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being...
It was good.
It was good. See, you keep doing this, you're going to get more Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Oh, yeah. Right. Not enough lifetime.
Oh, you got plenty of lifetime left. My thanks to everybody, to Rosemary and Terry and Vera. Of course, Alan, congratulations. And we'll be back after this.